order that we were doing, and we're going to let Assistant Commissioner Brian Osberg, who is in charge of the healthcare programs, talk first, because he has to catch a plane. So, Commissioner, when you can just go ahead and start, but when we get a quorum, I'll interrupt you and officially start the meeting.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and thank you for accommodating my schedule. However, I don't want to rush through the proposals. Obviously, we have a difficult set and complex set of proposals here, so I don't want to rush your deliberation around these either. But thank you for making the effort to accommodate my schedule. I decided one day off I have this winter is tomorrow, so I thought maybe I'd do this. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Osberg. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare. And what I'd like to do is present to you, of course, our healthcare change pages. You have in front of you a kind of an index or a table of contents as the order that we're going to go. It should be a one page with the budget pages on the left hand side and the topics on the right, indicating what order that I'd like to take you through, because I think it'd be useful for you to, as you assess the proposals, to look at it in these different categories. So if that's okay, I would like to proceed. So I'll jump around a little bit and I'll direct you to the budget page, but it shouldn't be too bad. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, these proposals cover Minnesota healthcare programs, medical assistance, Minnesota care, and general assistance medical care. The programs cover more than 670,000 people today, with that number expected to grow to approximately 709,000 by July 1st. This includes low-income families with children, adults without children, pregnant women, elderly, and people with disabilities, including those in nursing facilities. Approximately half of our clients are children. The governor's proposed budget results in a disenrollment of approximately 84,000 low-income adults who are currently enrolled in Minnesota care. This includes 55,000 adults without children who would lose coverage in Minnesota care effective January 2010, and 29,000 parents who would lose coverage in Minnesota care effective July of 2010. Mr. Chairman, under current law, enrollment in the Minnesota healthcare programs is expected to increase by approximately 100,000 people in the next 2 years. That's in large part due to the economy. With these proposed budget changes, enrollment will drop by 12,000 to just under 700,000 people in those 2 years. And we'll go through that in more detail in terms of the effect on enrollment later on. Children enrolled in Minnesota healthcare programs will also be affected by these proposals, not because of eligibility changes for children, but due to other factors, including the elimination of outreach efforts, the elimination of premium reductions, and also the elimination of the proposed MA transitional care program for kids coming off of MA eligibility. In total, there will be approximately 28,000 more children enrolled in our programs under these proposals by the end of biennium, but it will be 26,000 fewer than projected under current law. State spending for the current biennium for these programs is projected to be $4.7 billion. It is projected to be $6.27 billion for the next biennium, a 33% increase. This is due, as I said, in large part to the declining economy and thus resulting in growth in our enrollment. Under the governor's proposal, it is projected to be $5.23 billion, 11% increase. However, developments at the federal level, that I'm sure you're following as well as we are, including the reauthorization of the SCHIP program, the state children's health insurance program, and a stimulus package could have a major impact on financing our health care programs in the near term. And I'm going to talk more about that with you today. While it's too soon to speculate on how the stimulus package will affect the governor's proposal, we hope that it will be known before the production of the next budget forecast later this month. I will address this further in my presentation. Meanwhile, we are tracking the federal activity closely and can provide further analysis to the committee. So I'd like to start on page 92 of your book. And this next series of proposals relates to federal compliance. On page 92, this proposal would fund the implementation of the federally mandated public assistance reporting information system called TARIS for our various programs. This is a computer data matching system and information exchange system administered by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to improve program integrity. It matches state enrollment data with other states and selected federal databases in order to identify if individuals are enrolled in public programs in other states. This proposal provides funding for the necessary system changes and one FTE. There's an initial cost of $113,000, but we expect about $55,000 of savings every year after that. Any questions on page 93? Page 93, this proposal is for budget and statutory changes needed to implement the new federal requirements mandated in the 2008 Medicare legislation. The new Medicare law makes several changes to the administration of Medicare Part D low-income subsidy applications. You're familiar with that program for drug coverage, and Medicare savings programs, which we administer. Medicare savings programs is something that we provide in terms of a subsidy for premiums and cost sharing for low-income Medicare beneficiaries. They're not on Medicaid, but they're Medicare beneficiaries who are low-income. This is a placeholder at this point because we're awaiting guidance from CMS on these provisions. There's a $67,000 budgeted number for system changes necessary to make this happen, because what will happen is that applications for Medicare Part D for low-income subsidies, which are handled by Social Security Administration, will be transferred over to us to see whether or not they may be eligible for Medicare savings programs that we manage. So it's a very, I think, very helpful effort for Medicare beneficiaries.
Questions? Yeah, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a funny mic today. Commissioner Osberg, can you talk about how the funding on this change stage will be used to accomplish that goal? Can you just talk a little bit more about how you're going to spend the money, please?
Yes. In that case, we're going to be spending the money on system changes in order for us to accommodate any. In fact, we'll get to this later on. There's another effect as well in terms of the asset limits for these programs. But in order for us to accommodate this new change, the Medicare change, so we need to update our systems in order for that to happen. There's no FTE associated with this page. Mr. Chairman, member of committee.
The labor looks
fine. Well, I thought it'd be good, but I am, you know, I just, about the systems, and yesterday we talked about $2.5 million to do some compliance with some other stuff we have to do, and here's some more money going for systems. Is there an in-house systems group and then some stuff you contract for outside? And how do you decide what the difference is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Aber, no, our operations are entirely in-house. Some states they contract that out in terms of paying claims and things of that sort, or even in some cases they contract out to do eligibility determination. For Minnesota Care Operations, it's internal, and for our systems, our claim systems and all the systems, they're all internal.
All right, and some of us that through in almost my whole career through, I won't use a name, but HM is the acronym for a project that didn't go quite as well, and some of us haven't got the greatest confidence in how systems work goals. Is it smart to keep it internal? And sometimes in my work software, it's better to go buy a package that somebody designed. I know some companies spend a lot, the millions, and to do something that seems pretty ordinary. And I'm sure you think about that, but can you just give me the 30-second
answer? Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Apler, we do assess that periodically. We think it's very smart to keep it internal because we're able to adjust and be flexible to adjust changes, policy changes, much more effectively than if we had it contracted out.
30 seconds or something. Go ahead, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, page 94, this proposal would establish a reasonable limits policy, it's called, that allows unpaid medical expenses incurred up to 3 months before the effective date of eligibility for medical assistance long-term care to be deducted when calculating the client's current income that must be contributed to the cost of care that they're responsible for. Reducing the client's contribution to the cost of care results in an increase in MA expenditures of $500,000 a year. Minnesota's current policy on reasonable limits permits the client to deduct unpaid bills incurred during the current period of eligibility, while they're eligible, in other words. CMS did not approve this policy, however. and it was submitted as a state plan amendment. CMS determined that it should be consistent with rules for establishing MA eligibility under an income spend down, which is another part of our efforts to determine eligibility, which allows a deduction from income for expenses incurred prior to the eligibility period. So we do have to comply with this, with their not wanting to approve our provisions. So the proposal would also prohibit income deductions for the cost of services or equipment that are covered under the state plan. Again, this is a requirement that we need to comply with.
Sure.
It's a cost because the reduction in cost of care to our clients, that's an increased payment on our side.
Representative Abler,
I'm just helping you for later. There's going to be a, you'll have more meetings about this, I'm sure, but it looks like there's going to be a pile of stuff that we have to do that is going to cost money that'll be non-optional for us to not do. And later on, I mean, the chair and his group will have to, maybe I'll get to help a little bit, but we'll have to decide if we're going to do that after all. And so if, for instance, we wouldn't do some of these things that cost a few million dollars, are you going to go to jail then, or what happens?
Possibly. No, it could be sanctioned. If we're not in compliance, it could be sanctioned, which is a big financial penalty, potentially. So, no, we're pretty serious about complying with federal laws.
And so I just point that out, really, this is some of the budget is already out of our control that we thought we were going to try to control. So.
Representative Liebling.
Nope. Murphy.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I'm just wondering when the Fed ruled on this issue for us in the state health plan, when they denied the waiver that we were seeking.
Right.
If you could tell us when. Well, which administration?
Chairman,
how about which administration?
I don't. It's a state plan amendment, not a waiver.
Well, state plan amendment.
But
forgive me.
I don't recall. Last year, I assume. Past year, I assume we'll find that out exactly when it happened. But so it's not part of our waiver discussion. That took place. Paul, it's a separate state plan amendment request.
Mr. Chair, and you know, I get caught sometimes in the words, but I am wondering if the department will be talking to the new administration about this issue. Will there be any of these issues that we're being told we have to pay for? By the feds to comply, that will petition the new administration to see if they have a different perspective than the former administration had on that question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, our assumption is that we're going to have the opportunity to submit a lot of different changes to the new administration after this session, and so including how we're going to potentially comply with any federal stimulus package provisions. And, so we expect to have a great deal of discussion with them about ongoing policy issues, including perhaps this.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Page 95, this begins our discussion of various reform and simplification proposals. This proposal would eliminate the dollar limit, $350,000, on administrative costs retained by DHS from payments to school districts for covered IEP, special education plans, for services that provided to students. School districts provide the non-federal share of that, and we didn't administer all of that. So unfortunately, our costs are going to exceed $350,000 real fast. This provision was already adopted last year by this committee and by the legislature. It got caught up in another education bill that was vetoed. So we're asking that you, again, allow us the flexibility. We want to keep our administrative costs down around 2%, which is roughly $400,000. But at this point, we need to have an exception from the limit. Mr. Chairman, the next
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, could you just run that by us again, like in really simple terms? Like, what are we talking about? Keeping more money instead of giving it to schools? Is that what we're talking about here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, we are talking about retaining a little bit more money, right, that otherwise would go to the school district in order for us to administer this program. The cost of this program is growing, as everything else is. And so we're going to exceed the $350,000 limit. If we do that, we will not have the resources to manage this program effectively. Again, as I said, I'm trying to keep the administrative costs down to less than 2% over time here. Right now, there's a 5% limit already. We can't go over that. But it's also a $350,000 limit. And we intend to, again, we've worked this out with the school districts and the Department of Education. This is satisfactory to them. They realize that they need our support to administer this program. We miss everything from fraud and abuse to IEP policy to everything else. And this is critical that we have the resources to do this. And so it's asking, it's about state financial impact, and we've worked this out with the school district.
Commissioner, what's the total budget that for this particular area that you're going to administer?
If 5% is $1 million, then it's 20 times that. It's $20 million. If it's schooners? Well, that's too, maybe too simple, though. We'll find out.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Vicki Twiner from the Department of Human Services. The 06-07 school year, we spent over $46 million in providing Medicaid federal dollars to match the school districts for the they have the non-federal share. We just bring in the federal dollars. These are administrative dollars that retain some of the federal dollars to administer it. There's no state funds spent. I mean, there's no state general funds from our agency spent on that.
Thank you.
Chairman, I'd like to then jump to page 130 in your book and talk about the proposal to realign the asset limit for parents, medical assistants, and Minnesota Care with the MA asset limit for the elderly, blind, and disabled. Under current law, parents in MA and Minnesota Care have an asset limit of $10,000 for a household of one and $20,000 for a household of two or more. The asset limits would be $3,000 for a household of one and $6,000 for a household of two, and $200 each additional dependent. The MA asset limit for parents would be reduced effective January 1st, 2010. Minnesota Care asset limit would be reduced effective July 2010. Upon federal approval. This proposal represents both a reduction in the asset limits to achieve savings, but also provides for program simplification for purposes of processing our applications more effectively. We're trying to streamline the application process. So it's a simplification effort, but it's also a savings.
If you're reducing the asset limits, then there will be, you're changing the eligibility requirements, I guess, and how many people will be lose health care coverage?
We're calculating that there'll be about 783 MA parents that would be affected.
And how about Minnesota Care?
Well, Minnesota Care, given that this interacts with a page that's coming up later, Minnesota Care parents will not have coverage.
Yeah. And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, are the besides aligning the asset limit, is there an alignment in what's counted as an asset?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, that's a very good question. No, this proposal makes no changes to the methodology for counting assets for MA or Minnesota Care parents. We have not done that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, are there big differences in what counted as an asset under each of these programs? And if I'm assuming there probably are, I mean, it seems to me that the asset limits are probably the least of our problems in getting these things aligned.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't know how widely different they are, and we will get that to you during the course of our meeting today. Maybe we do have a...
Mr. Chair, members, Karen Zusto, I work for DHS. For the most part, what is counted for the parents versus elderly and disabled on MA, they do have very many similarities. There are a few things that are different, and we can provide that information in more detail.
Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through a testifier, we saw in the early childhood area that they took down asset limits were changed on cars, so the way a vehicle value is calculated. So are you just taking down the asset limits sort of, is this part of the 3% reductions and everything, or why what's the rationale for the reduction in all of these different asset limits? And which, as Representative Huntley, the chair, said, it really changes eligibility overall.
Mr. Chairman, again, the rationale is for saving, frankly, and also to simplify, to align the asset limits for all our programs. Now, nothing's changing in terms of how we treat certain assets, like households, a home or a car or a burial fund and things of that sort. That's not being affected here at all in terms of what we exempt from the asset limits. But there's some methodologies in terms of calculation that currently we opted not to align at this point, and I don't frankly have a reason why we didn't go that far, but we'll find that out.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lauer.
I hope we would find that out. And then for us, because we're trying to make sense of all this, if we could see the big picture of how the asset limits changed. I mean, because we're seeing page by page and showing up in different committees and so forth. So if at some point we have the broad view of that, if you work things that way between the departments and the different budget pages. Would that be possible?
In fact, yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik, we do have, in the, if you go back, you should have on page 17 in the green section of your book, there's a graph depicting the income standards for our programs, and right before that, there's a graph indicating the green graph on page 15 indicating the SPG income standards plus the assets. Look at the bottom line of page 15, asset test. You can see what the various asset limits are for each program. And what we're going to do here is kind of, like I said, we're lining all that up in terms of $3,000 and $6,000 is what we're doing. Does that help any?
Yes. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, if I could extrapolate a little in looking at whether or not to align the asset methodology, there were places in which we saw that if we were to align the asset methodology, we would have to expand eligibility. For example, for MA parents, things like IRAs, retirement funds, are an excluded asset, and under Minnesota Care, those things are excluded. Where they are not excluded for the age-blind disabled programs. And so if we were going to align, we would have to, in fact, broaden what is excluded overall. And so we did not choose to do that in this proposal.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Mr. Osberg, and this may be a more general question since we're getting into this category of state programs, medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, and so forth. I understand what the governor's budget is trying to do here with regard to reducing enrollment eligibility. We've got potentially a $6 to $7 billion deficit we're trying to deal with, and reducing enrollment one approach, although I would note as I'm looking just here at the statistics for general assistance medical care that, you know, we're actually looking at enrollment projections through 2010 similar to what we had back in 2007. What concerns me more and what I'd like an answer to is what is the department doing to reduce the per enrollee costs? Because those have been going up dramatically. I mean, just on general assistance medical care alone, the cost per enrollee, 2007 we were at slightly more than $8,000. 2010 projection is $10,381 per enrollee, and that continues to ramp up. That's a deep area of concern. Our enrollees have been staying relatively stable, but it's the dollars per enrollee that seem to really be swamping us.
Chairman, Representative Caldwell, we're doing a number of things on that front. In fact, we had authority in the last couple of years to be more aggressive in terms of how we do medical management for our programs.
including identifying what services work and do not work, based on evidence, based on research. We're doing that. We're also aggressively managing our pharmacy area. We've now have a over 70% generic substitution level. So we've also been very aggressive in applying maximum allowable cost piece to generic drugs. We have entered into multi-stage rebate arrangements on drugs. We're also introducing, of course, two programs, intensive care coordination, whereby we're for the sickest segment of our clients to make sure that they have a care coordination model available for them to manage those costs. We also have something called primary care coordination model that was just approved by the federal government. We're also developing the healthcare home model. We're developing all of these things simultaneously in order to manage the utilization effect, and that's what you're referring to, because utilization times price, and we're trying to manage the utilization effect the best we can. And so we're in the process of doing of all of that.
Commissioner, how do you do a medical home for somebody that's on general assistance hospital only?
Mr. Chairman, you don't. General assistance hospital only is for a program that it's episodic. If you go in, somebody between 75 and 175 of poverty guidelines, best income guidelines, go into hospital. We pay for the hospital services and physician services with $1,000 deductible, if you will. And so there is, hopefully what happens after that is they enroll in general assistance medical care, which we retain in our proposals here. And they enroll there, and there they'll have a healthcare home available to them over time here once it's developed.
Representative Gottwalt, I was just I think last year we talked about the hospital system in Texas that is just providing pre-primary care to some people so that they don't have to give them the care in the emergency room. And some of our hospitals in Minneapolis right now are doing the same thing. They've decided it's cheaper for them to provide primary care and keep them out of the hospital than it is to wait till they show up at the emergency room.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a good point. I hope we do focus more energy there, because these cost per enrollees are going to swamp us if we don't start getting a grip on this. So I wonder if the Minnesota Hospital Association is interested in providing free primary care.
I'm going to
say they already are.
Thanks. And just a technical thing. I was looking at the tails on here, and the tails go down. Can you explain? Usually the tails and these kinds of things go up, and so the savings accumulate. Especially the savings is more front end loaded, than it kind of tapers. Can you just explain why that is?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I can't offhand. I'll have our. Yeah. I'm sure somebody here.
It doesn't matter for now, unless you can see. It's just a curious anomaly for most of these kinds of things.
I assume it's a function of people enrolling in our program.
Mr. Chair, I want him to testify if he can. I have a question for Mr. Greenman.
At the Department of Human Services. I think originally the budgeted reduction is bigger because there's people currently on the program who are going to be removed from the program. So you've got all that accumulated enrollment that's going to be, or at least reducing their enrollment. And then once that disenrollment is done, then you've got certain other people. You're not enrolling new people after that.
Mr. Representative, we're trying to be good. I'm glad you're at the table, though, Mr. Greenman. But wouldn't those people that are off the program be continually off the program, and so the accumulated effect of those people not on it would affect the forecast in the out years too? Should they still be out? Unless they spend all their money, and just it doesn't matter. It just kind of puzzled me.
Yeah, but I think it's still going to be a smaller population.
All right. Thanks.
Okay, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, page 131, this proposal aligns the asset limit for individuals enrolled in the Medicare Savings Program or what we call MSP, with the asset limit for individuals who apply for the Medicare Part D low-income subsidy, which I just explained earlier. The low-income subsidy provides assistance with premiums and cost-sharing for certain individuals enrolled in Medicare Part D. Medicare savings programs provide assistance to low-income Medicare beneficiaries to pay for the premiums and cost-sharing. If you look back on page 17 of your green section, you will see on the right-hand side of that graph our Medicare savings programs and income standards for that effort. It's called QWD, Q1, QI1, and FLIMBY and QUIMBY. Roles involved, but depending on a person's income, we subsidize their Medicare premium or cost sharing. This proposal aligns the MSP asset limit with the LIS, the Medicare Part D asset limit, to $6,600 for a single person and $9,910 for a married couple. Right now it's $10,000 for a single person and $18,000 for a married couple. And you see the savings associated with that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thanks very much, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osberg, taking a risk and appearing like I don't know what I'm talking about, can you talk about this program just more in general? Is this new? Is this low-income subsidy for Medicare, is this new following the passage of Medicare Part D?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, right. It's part of Medicare Part D when I was enacted. There was a device for a low-income subsidy to help people pay for their medication, or for their actually pay for their premium to enroll into a Medicare Part D program.
Okay.
There's about 370 enrollees affected, which you don't have on the graph. 370 enrollees affected by this case.
We're
better off if they're on Medicare, because that's 100% federal, and if they're on medical assistance, we have to pay half. I'll interrupt briefly to call the meeting to order. We now have a quorum, and would somebody like to move the minutes? Representative Fritz moves the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are adopted, and we'll continue with the testimony. Mr.
Chairman,
Mr.
Members of the committee, page 132 of your book. This proposal would amend medical assistance and state recovery statutes to create the authority for counties and states more appropriately collect from the estate of the recipient's surviving spouse for MA benefits received. Under Minnesota and federal law, a recovery from a claim may not be made until after the death of a surviving spouse. I believe you all know. Minnesota law limits a claim against the non-recipient spouse's estate for benefits received by the recipient spouse to the value of property in the estate that was marital property or jointly owned property at any time during the marriage. However, a recent Minnesota Supreme Court decision held that MA recoveries from spousal estates are limited to the recipient's legal interest at the time of death. The decision allows MA recoveries in situations where recipients... This allows MA recoveries in situations where recipients transfer property to the community spouse prior to death, like through a quick claim deed. So this proposal would amend state law to create marital interest as legal title interest for MA estate recovery, allowing counties and the state to collect from the estate of the recipient's surviving spouse for MA benefits received. We are petitioning that decision, that Minnesota Supreme Court decision, to the U.S. Supreme Court. That petition is pending at this point. This was, in essence, put back and clarify current law that we have, that whereby we would recognize that any marital property, joint property, prior to the death of the recipient would be possible recovery in terms of the surviving spouses at the time the surviving spouse died.
So, Mr. Osberg, let's suppose the husband is in a nursing home and he spent down and got an MA, and the wife and he had assets of how much, and how did he ever get eligible for MA if those assets were that high?
Well, again, it's also from the assets. Of course, not all assets are counted, as you know, as far as that. It's very possible, because you have some exceptions to the asset limits. It's possible that the person would transfer property during the course of their during the course of time in the nursing home. But I'm going to do is bring Dale Sinsky down from our benefit recovery area and to talk about how that scenario may play out.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dale Klitsky. I work with the Department of Human Services. Specifically, what this amendment is doing is creating a clarification to our current policy and procedures, which were, I guess, muddied up by a recent Minnesota Supreme Court decision. In the facts in that case, specifically what happened was the MA recipient, the wife, was in a long-term care facility, and she transferred her home to the community spouse, the husband. This transfer is allowed by federal law as well as state law. And at her death, she did not have legal title because she transferred that over. We did not collect at that time because there's a surviving spouse. We made a claim in the surviving spouse's estate once he died 7 months later. And at that time, the claim was denied. On the sense that the recipient, the first to die, did not have legal title in the property. This is to clarify our current policy that we collect on marital interest, and so that, you know, the payer of last resort is the state, and that husband and wife pay for each other's medical needs. This amendment makes that clarification and allows us to do so.
And do you think that will stand any court challenges?
I think in the Minnesota Supreme Court, they specifically allowed us to collect in the surviving spouse's estate. They said that was allowed. That was challenged, but they made the decision saying, yes, you're allowed to do so. What they did say was that you're only allowed to collect on interest that is legal and current. And so they were saying that the marital interest that we had at the time in our statute was not defined, and that it did not pass at death. This amendment does do that. It makes the marital interest a title interest. It also continues after death, and only in the area of medical assistance does this happen.
Representative Abler.
So probably this amount of money that you're recapturing was once in the forecast because you thought you could get it before you're disallowed from getting it, I would suppose. But you can answer that with my other question. And this is only done, the state's not going to go after a surviving spouse until there's an estate of that surviving spouse. Is that right? We're not going to go after widows with this, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ava, not until the surviving spouse passes away do we do any recovery, certainly. And you're right, the forecast reflected this. The forecast changed because of the Supreme Court decision, and that's, we need to recover financially from that.
Thank you.
Page 133, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this proposal would modify medical assistance policy that allows a person to become eligible by reducing certain assets. The proposal will allow a person to become eligible by paying bills for health services incurred during the period for which eligibility is sought. Normally 3 months back, that's normally what we look for in terms of medical assistance eligibility. Expenditures that are not for health services incurred during the period for which eligibility is sought will no longer count towards reducing assets to the MA limit. We just think it's appropriate that only health care services being paid for helps to reduce your assets down to your $6,000 or $3,000 limit and not other related expenses that they may have. And so we think that this is good policy as well as achieve some savings, as indicated on the on page 133.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. What are the other expenditures that we're eliminating? I mean, healthcare versus non-healthcare is not very descriptive.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, everything other than healthcare expenses we're eliminating in terms of expenses for...
I guess the question is, what were we paying for now? What are we paying for now that's being eliminated? I'm assuming we didn't pay for... Is it everything that we pay for now?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we recognize, in terms of the spend down, if you will, we recognize any expenses during that three-month period of time. So it could be
food
and...
Okay.
Mortgage payments
or entertainment of any sort, of anything that they would, other than health care.
Well, that's helpful. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, page 135, this proposal makes a number of changes related to the MA treatment of pool trusts and special needs trusts and limits the conditions under which a period of ineligibility for an uncompensated transfer can be adjusted. To clarify, the transfer of assets into a pool trust for a person 65 or older must be evaluated as a transfer for less than fair market value. And that's what we determine whether or not there's a penalty period. If there's something that's transferred in the period looking back that's less than market value, that then contributes or then determines whether or not there's a penalty period by which eligibility is not in play. This policy is consistent with guidance DHS has received from CMS. Pool trusts and special needs trusts are two types of trusts for disabled individuals recognized under state and federal law. This proposal will do three things. One is require trustees to submit an annual financial report to DHS for a pool trust or a special needs trust when the beneficiary of the trust is a Minnesota Healthcare Program's enrollee. Number two is that it clarifies that transfer of assets into a pool trust for a person 65 or older must be evaluated as a possible transfer. Not that it's assumed that it is, but must be evaluated for possible transfers for less than fair market value. And number three requires that on the death of a pool trust beneficiary, any funds remaining in the MA recipient's subaccount be used to fully reimburse the state for the cost of providing MA before any subaccount funds can be retained by the trust. The other aspect of this is the uncompensated transfer proposal would require the full amount of transferred assets to be returned to a person who is applying within 12 months of the start date of a penalty period to eliminate the penalty period. We no longer allow the recalculation of a penalty period based on a partial return of transferred assets. Now, a hardship waiver of the penalty period may be granted in some situations when a person is unable to recover the full value of transferred assets. So that is what our policy is, to see if or not we can recover the full value of assets that were not transferred based on fair market value.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on that first piece, are you guys going to be able to do anything with those reports? I mean, do you have the staff to do anything with them, or are they just going to sit there?
Mr. Chairman, no, we intend to evaluate those. We intend to...
Do you know how many there'll be?
I don't know how many reports that we would expect to get. Do we have anybody to...
Yeah, we can get it later.
I can get it later, but anybody can guess the number of reports we're talking about?
Fewer than 1,000.
Fewer than 1,000? Okay. Thank you. Fewer than 1,000, Mr. Chairman. Page 137 relates to non-emergency medical transportation. You've dealt with this issue in the past. This proposal would allow contracting for special transportation services in the 11 county metropolitan area. Contracting meaning for coordination of those services in the metropolitan area for fee-for-service clients. We've done this in the past. We discontinued this a year or two ago based on a legislative directive. Currently, a vendor contracted by DHS coordinates access transportation, which is obviously less intense than special transportation, in the 11 county metro area. This does not expand any coordination beyond the 11 county metro area. The coordinator also certifies clients for the SDS level of service statewide by providing a level of need assessment, and they've been doing that for some time. Under this proposal, DHS would be authorized to contract with a vendor for the management of SDS services in the Levin County metro area. It's true, early on in that process, we had some issues. We had issues especially with coordinating that effort with our nursing homes and some of our group homes. However, we're very confident that this can be done effectively. And at this point, given the financial situation we're facing, we're asking that the legislature reinstate our authority to contract with somebody to coordinate our special transportation services. This is saves $1 million for the biennium.
Commissioner, what it's you know, $500,000 a year. Do you have any? Where did you get the estimate that that's what it will save?
Mr. Chairman, we got the estimate again from, as you know, our forecast team that economists and researchers come up with this estimate based on past experience, what we had in terms of special transportation coordination and current. Of course, current trend in terms of cost, which we see going up, obviously, and so it's based on experience as well as the trending of current SDS costs.
And what did we do? Was it 2007? We did something with this,
Mr. Chairman.
Provider?
In 2007, we eliminated our authority to do special transportation service coordination to a any sort.
Thank you. Representative Legal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Osberg, how was this coordinator paid? Is it a flat contract rate or is it a per unit of service rate? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, correct me if I'm wrong, but we paid them on a trip basis. So we pay them based on how many trips they're actually coordinating.
Representative Liebling.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. I guess obviously this has been very controversial, and I have to say I haven't followed the controversy entirely, but I guess I would really like to get more information, really following on Representative Huntley's question, to demonstrate that this actually saves money. Because I think the premise in this is that without this coordination, there's some kind of overuse going on. Or that we're using a level of service that's unnecessary for the particular clients and that this vendor somehow gets rid of that. And I guess I'd like to just ask, you don't have to answer it now, but as we go forward with this, given this request, I'd like to see some demonstrated proven savings on this.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, we will do that. We'll break out administrative costs associated with this as well in terms of how that would be financed. But to your point, exactly why we think we need to do this coordination is because of not appropriately using access transportation services when we can, but also making sure that we're tracking properly the accounting of these SDS trips. You want to add something?
Chris Reiser from the Department of Human Services. I think what we're seeing is that we compared activity when the broker was in process compared to what was happening after the brokering ended, and we are experiencing increased number of trips, increased number of miles per trip. So I think that's the basis of the fiscal note, where we can give you more specific information on that. Just for your information, the special transportation services is the highest level of non-emergency medical transportation. It requires the resources of the driver to go into the home, get the person into the vehicle, and take the person into the desk of the provider. But we can certainly give you more specific information and details about the fiscal piece of this.
Representative Abler.
You know, we just had Groundhog Day, Mr. Chair. This we've talked about this a lot. This could be a one-hour discussion, which I'm not going to do that.
Mr. Chair, we will be having an hour or more in policy committee. So
and I can't wait. Yeah.
Keep that
so
in
mind. Just on the money questions, what percentage of trips do you think are necessary? Is this 500,000, 10% of trips, 5%, 20%? What do you expect? That's my one question.
I would have to check to see what I'm not sure. So we can check on that as part of the other.
For the other hearing one. Yeah. Thank you.
Chairman, on page 138, Mr. Popola would increase the mileage rate for special transportation services for people who require a wheelchair accessible van, and decrease the mileage rate for SPS services for people who do not require such a van, to ensure continued access, especially in rural areas. Not all people who have met the level of need for SPS are in wheelchairs. Ambulatory people who have cognitive or physical disabilities may qualify for ambulatory SPS if they need such assistance. SPS providers in rural areas have been experiencing financial hardships because of miles traveled and fewer trips, affecting access for our clients. This proposal, effective July 1st, increases per mile rate for SPS services for people who require a wheelchair accessible van from $1.35 to $1.80, and decreases the rate for SPS services for people who do not require such a van from $1.30 to $1. And this results in a slight savings, as you see on this page. But we also think that this addresses some of the concerns that we have in the rural areas in terms of ongoing access to transportation, SPS transportation, for our clients.
So, Mr. Osberg, there's savings here, so we're going to spend less money. So obviously some providers are going to get less.
Mr. Chairman, exactly. The impact probably be on the metro side in terms of the savings as to how we're paying for metro rides.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Osberg. I was lobbied heavily on this by the local provider in my area who cover a lot of rural area, and that was happening back when gas prices were really, really high, and now they've dropped. And so, you know, it occurs to me that a lot of the issue around this has to do with the changing price of fuel, and obviously they have other cost pressures as well, but I'm just wondering if it would make some sense to do something that actually takes account of the current price of fuel, rather than just, you know, making a blanket rate change, especially since we're in this era when fuel does seem to go up and down. I mean, since the fuel prices dropped, I haven't heard any more about it from the people who were just desperate when that was happening. So, you know, I guess I'd be, and again, maybe we don't have to know right now, but I'd really like to know what calculations go into these new rates.
Mr. Chairman, we'll provide that for you. I'd like to now go to page 117 in your book and go over some payment delays.
Representative got a question.
Commissioner Osberg, yes. I have a question. Why were the farmers' depreciation add back included in not included in the latest TMAT rate waiver?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Trema, it was included in the most recent waiver request and it was denied by CMS. We tried. I can assure you, we tried our best to. And those negotiations were hard and long. It took over a year to finalize, and we tried our best to convince them to accept that piece, and it was not accepted. I'm sorry to say.
Representative Otrumba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You think there's a chance again because we have different leadership?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Otrumba, I do not know that. I'm not sure. I don't think the basis of the decision by CMS was necessarily on policies around their rules and regulations. So unless they change, I don't know if the outcome would change. Chairman, page 117 began a series of proposals that relate to provider payment delays. This proposal increases the financial withhold amount for Minnesota Care Managed Care contracts to align with what we have in medical assistance and GAMC. It also eliminates the withhold exemption for the Minnesota Disability Health Options Program. We have a 5% withhold that the health plans are at risk for. We have an additional 3% that we put into place last year, in which they're not at risk for, but is used for us to do an accounting adjustment to allow us to capture some savings
Additional 3% would be automatically returned to the humanitarianization. The language excluding special demonstration projects such as Minzo from the WIPO would be repealed. The first 5% would be subject to performance outcome and targets, and the other 3% would not be. This results in 7.8 million savings in the 10-11 biennium.
Sure. Personal labor.
At first I thought this was a shift, and then you said that there was some accounting. It wouldn't all automatically be withheld if there was some accounting issue then, right? This is a way to just give you a cushion so you don't have to ask them for a check?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, we don't book any shortcomings on the 5%. In other words, if there is some, if they don't get all the return back because they didn't fulfill the contractual requirements, we don't know that for sure, so we can't book it, certain savings. So we have to, in essence, assume that the 5% will be returned back to the health system.
But
that's not always the case, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, because recently they did not get the withhold back entirely.
Right. But I thought you just said in your testimony that there was some accounting that could happen in the 3% if you overpaid something. Is that?
Oh, no, did I hear that right? Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, 3%, the additional 3% simply is the payment delay. It's withholding the money. As you know, we have a cash system in terms of accounting, and you'll see a series of these as to how we do some. This is not a shift, but there's some shifts coming.
Okay.
In a few minutes.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is going to kind of not to this proposal, but I just wanted to get a sense of, you know, the S-CHIP bill just passed by President Obama. Do you guys have any sense of what that's going to mean for us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we do. We expect at this point that will add $11.75 million per year to our allotment. $10 million of that by covering kids between 133% and 150% of FPG of income. The other $1.75 million would be from covering pregnant women and children who are legal immigrants. Up to this point, the state 800% of MA coverage for legal immigrants for the first 5 years. The money will be available to us now to pay for pregnant women and kids who are legal immigrants. And that 11.75 is each year. Now, also, though, there is paid for by tax increase, the tobacco tax increase. Now, the Department of Revenue is calculating what the impact of that's going to be in terms of our collection of our tax, tobacco tax, because there's elasticity around that, of course, and so they expect there's going to be a reduction in our tobacco tax collections because they're increasing the federal tax by 62 cents to do this. So we don't know what the net number is going to be. For our programs, it's going to be $11.75 million a year. Now, that's somewhat minor compared to the stimulus package proposals, which is around $2 billion a year for additional Medicaid match in both bills at this point.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, that's helpful. Just one, so the like 1.75 million, basically that'll just free up some more state dollars, which is how that would work. Because
the Chairman, Representative, it frees up state dollars to expense, well, they also get, you have that tax, the revenue offset, and so I don't know what the net result is going to be to the state, bottom line.
No, I'm not saying that, but just within our programs, it would basically free up about, we're spending at least that amount on these,
right,
on legal immigrants. Okay.
Right.
And, are we going to talk about the stimulus package at some other time?
I think we ought to have a separate meeting,
yeah,
on that.
Yeah, good.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osberg, can you talk with us just a little bit about the performance targets, and if we, does the legislature get a report back on the plans that don't make the performance targets? Do we get information about that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the performance targets are a combination of administrative targets and clinical targets. You know, blood lead testing, for example. We have five or six such targets. We do not report routinely to the legislature the outcome of that, but we certainly, it's public information. And we could do that. We could give you the most recent results, for example.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Osberg, that would be great. Thank you.
Chairman, page 118. This proposal would eliminate the first 3 months of the calendar year 2011 rebasing of hospital rates under medical assistance in GAMC. Now, this impacts future payments to the hospitals. Let me clarify exactly how this works. Every 2 years, hospitals get a rebasing based on their actual specific costs. We expect in the next 4 years, in fact, in the forecast, there's going to be an increase to hospitals of $370 million the next 4 years because of this rebasing, which will take place in 2011 and 2013. This is taking back $21 million of that that amount in 2011. It's 3 months. It's worth $21 million. Now, this is the state share. There's also a federal share on medical assistance. Remember, when you think about hospital payments, the medical assistance is twice because there's a 50% state and 50% federal. General assistance medical care is all state money. So when you're trying to get an impact about federal impact on some of the payments to hospitals, you need to think in those terms. In fact, we could break that down in different fashion. But what this proposal does is carves out, if you will, we retain 3 months worth of the rebasing that the hospitals were expected to get in 2011. Now, I'm not suggesting that this entirely mitigates some of the tough cuts that we're proposing to hospitals the next couple of years. The next couple of years is going to be very tough for our hospitals based on what we're going to propose, and it's going to add to their uncompensated care obligations. But you need to look at this in terms of what, over time, what the larger financial picture looks like. So that's what this page does, Mr. Chairman, is retain $21 million of a future increase to hospitals.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Osberg, what does the larger financial picture look like overall? Do you have a prediction as to what we can expect?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, in terms, it's not good. In terms of the hospital community and the healthcare community, you're seeing what's happening in terms of layoffs. You're seeing what's happening in terms of them getting impacted not only by utilization reduction because some of the difficulties for people to pay for their hospital systems and delaying elective procedures, but also they got hit, of course, in the investment portfolio. They got hit in some cases in terms of having to refinance their debt service, and that's gone up depending on the situation. They've also had, there's been an increase in uncompensated care because of the increase in uninsurance rates in the state the last couple of years because the employer is not able to provide coverage. It is a very difficult time, and it's been characterized as a perfect storm for a lot of the healthcare systems at this point. And I would, unfortunately, these proposals contribute to that obligation.
Representative, we're going to have a hearing on this joint meeting with Policy Committee next week. We're going to hear from the providers about this, their financial status.
So is that the gentleman's way of telling me to stop? Or
No, go ahead. I've been calling. Representative Emmer, I've been called a lot of things, but the gentleman is usually not one of them.
I'm one of the few people who would call you a gentleman. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Osberg, when we do have that joint meeting, would you bring specific information relating to the areas that you just discussed? I'd like to see the numbers that relate to layoffs, what positions we're talking about. I'd like to know what investments you're telling me, the portfolios, exactly what was invested in and what they've dropped, so I can understand what types of business decisions were being made in the community. And then the last one had to do with, I forget the last one.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I would suggest that you ask the healthcare system to bring that in. They have the data, of course, as to what the impact has been on them. The health department can provide you an idea as to what's going on in terms of uncompensated care or in terms of uninsured rate. That's what you probably might want to get from the health department. We don't have that
data available at our department. But
well, Representative Emmer, they've been in my office, and they have the data, and they will bring it to that.
Well, and I would like the uncompensated care. And I, Mr. Chairman, the only reason I presented it to Mr. Osberg was he is an expert in the area, and clearly, as they're developing policies and he's involved in, based on his testimony, he's taking into account these factors when he's testifying about what the future holds. So I presume that that's based on specific facts and figures, and I don't care who brings it, but I'd like to see it.
Now, I can tell you one of the big delivery systems is their reserves are down to the point they've got about 1 day of margin before they lose their credit rating on their bonds. So it's very serious. But they'll be here to testify. And I would I'm assuming the hospital association is around here someplace. Maybe if you could get that information, not just to me, but to all the members of the committee, it would be helpful.
And Mr. Chairman, I don't care what anybody else says. You are a gentleman.
Mr. Chairman, on page 119.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Abler wants to contest that last statement, I think.
No, not even going there. We're just all humble servants here, Mr. Chair. But also, when we have that meeting, it would be productive for me and I think for all the members here that if we could see how much we give to hospitals, because I know that I hear about this $21 million cut, which is a reduction and an increase, and I don't know how much we give them, and I don't know if it's gone up or down. And I think if there's a global chart about just showing like what it was in 2000 and what it is today, and is it, you know, that would be really helpful. And the different sources that go with that, I think it would be helpful as we consider what this impact is.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I would agree. In fact, we offer that to the Senate as well, as come in and show you exactly how hospitals get paid in our system. It's very convoluted and very complicated, to say the least. And I think you should see all of the parts as to how hospitals get paid. We're addressing some of them today, not all of them at all. There's everything from intergovernmental transfers to special payments, outlier provisions, things of that sort. I think we'd be glad to provide a primer to you as to how hospitals get paid under our system. It's more complicated than Medicare, let me tell you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment, Representative Abler. We don't give hospitals anything. Maybe what we do is give chiropractors, but we pay hospitals for service they provide.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members, page 119. This proposal would delay the last payment of fiscal years 2010 and 2011 for selected non-hospital providers. Simply put, we payments due in June 2010 would be made in July 2010, and payments due in June 2011 would be made in July 2011. Again, this is we exempt certain providers, especially providers who rely heavily on Medicaid cash, which are nursing facilities, ICFMRs, home and community-based services, personal care provider organizations, and home health agencies. But others would be subject to this shift. What it is, it's a shift from this biennium to the next biennium. And same with page 120, it's the inpatient shift, the June payment delay, and does the same, that's the same thing, for in this case, for hospitals. Again, page 121, this proposal, I'm going to get now into reimbursement changes that a series of proposals address these changes. Page 121, this proposal would eliminate the critical access dental add-on payments for Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance Programs. In part because based on a recent analysis that we did, the critical access dental payments do not add to any improved access. Our access is flattened up. It hasn't gotten worse in terms of access for our clients to dental services. But this does not remarkably improve that access. However, the biggest reason we're doing this, frankly, is because of the cost associated with it. That's the biggest factor. And we're then eliminating the add-on payment, which is 30% for MA and 50% for Minnesota Care, add-on to their fee schedule. And it's
result in $12.2 million in total savings for 10 and 11 biennium.
Mr.
Chair? Representative Abler.
In part of the donations to providers who do work on behalf of the state, Representative Liebling referenced that earlier, most of these providers who engage in this service do it below cost. And my profession, most of the primary clinics, the hospitals, they have a lot of volume, and it's probably better uncompensated care for them. The dentists do it at a deep discount on extremely hard costs. Some might talk to scale like and lay off the staff or something and not, ramp up, but they have, their costs are even more hard than I think many costs. Do you have any data that says if you reduce what you're paying them, that you'll have a more of a reduction? Has that been in your chart on the fiscal note? Did you figure?
Mr. Chairman, remember the paper. If you looked in a later proposal here, eliminate completely dental coverage for adults. I continue to have coverage for kids. At this point, I don't know if there is a specific impact analysis as to what would happen in covering kids. Dentists and other providers are required to see our clients, if they call Rule 101, if they wish to see other public employees. But I don't know, I'm not aware of any impact that was done in terms of access to children if critical access payments.
Thank you.
Are you asking for that, Mr.?
Pardon?
Mr. Aver, are you asking for that kind of analysis?
Well, let me just, I'll be specific. I know we have to make some hard decisions, and I'm game for that. But I just want to know all the data we can, as we're here to work on this, and as are you, and I understand your heart and all this, and I don't think you like a lot of what you're having to tell us here. But you had a job to do. But it would be helpful for me to see what data the department had when they, for instance, did cut physical therapy or cut chiropractic or cut dental, to see what they figured in the, as the balloon shifts from the lower cost providers that you remove to the higher cost places they're going to go, be the ER or a orthopedic surgeon or something. So there's other services that are going to be, if the people need the service, they're going to get it somewhere. And there must have been in the some dynamic part of the fiscal notes, I know they're kind of static notes, but there must have been at least one add-on piece for increased use elsewhere. And that would, I asked the commissioner, and I'll just ask you formally for that, not now because it's too long of a question, but there's got to be some sheets on each of these programs.
Mr. Chairman, there are, in terms of we get to benefit changes and benefit reductions, there are certainly, we have some assumptions there in terms of the impact as to what other costs may occur because of eliminating a benefit. This add-on payment, what we tend to do is get you the report that was submitted to the legislature as to the effect of the critical access payment program on terms of our access for our clients. We can get that to you. But we did not take consideration in this case a potential impact on access. We didn't. If we get to the adult dental piece, we'll talk about what ER costs may go up because of eliminating adult dental, and we recognize that in our fiscal note.
Mr. Chair, I don't. I don't want to. The public forum is. This is too complicated of a question to. We spent an hour on this single element of it, but I see Dr. Schiff here. And maybe he should just come talk to me personally, and he can bring the papers, and that'll help me as I offer advice to the committee. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Page 122.
Representative Broad is next.
Thank you. And actually, it's just a follow-up to the direction I think Representative Abler was going as well. As I look at these pages, we look at them separately, but they interact, obviously, in pretty important ways. And I was curious about the transportation relationship between transportation costs of moving people from place to place to get care versus the access. So when we think about dentistry, we all know that in rural areas you end up having to transport people greater distances because of lack of access. And so I'm trying to connect the dots on those two pieces in terms of how we get the best bang for the buck and provide people the best opportunity to care, recognizing the challenges that and cuts that are going to be coming forward, or reprioritization, whatever you want to call it. Is there a way for you to link those two pieces for me in an easy manner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, that's a very good point, and that is if indeed there is an impact in terms of number of dentists participating because of the elimination of this critical access payment, then there would require greater transportation. to get to a dentist that does participate. I think what we need to address first is, and we will, is whether or not we think that it's going to be an impact in terms of access to children for dental services, and if so, what additional costs may be incurred on the transportation side. Thank you for that's a very good point. Mr. Chairman, page 122, this proposal would limit the medical education research costs, what we call MERC, carve-out of the medical assistance capitation rates, comply with new federal requirements, and also to restore fiscal year 2009 MERC payments, which were part of the governor's unallotment. I'll talk about that further. And also to delay transfer of MERC funds later in the biennium. As background, Mr. Chairman, in October 2008, DHS received new terms and conditions that limit MERC spending associated with our MA managed care populations as part of the renewal of the federal waiver. Beginning with fiscal year 2011, medical education payments associated with our managed care populations and distributed to providers are limited in fiscal year 2010 and 2011 to the level of payments made in 2009. So they're kind of saying we're going to flatten out going forward your MERC payments. Total MERC payments for fiscal year 2009 are projected to be $34 million, which is arrived at by subtracting the $38 million that was caused by the unallotment action from the $72 million cap. To address that and to remedy that, these are the three components of this proposal. One is amending the MERC and MA capitation rate statutes to ensure that total medical education carve-outs and spending related to MA managed care beneficiaries does not exceed the newly imposed federal limits. This results in MA savings because there will not be, as increases in capitation rates take place, we will not be carving out additional MERC money. Second, in fiscal year 2010, this proposal restores $38 million in MERC funding from the governor's 2009 unallotment actions. This fully restores the fiscal year 2009 MERC payments and restores the federal limit to $72 million. This restoration is partially financed by temporary reduction of $28 million in the fiscal year 10 MERC payments. This also delays the transfer of MERC funds carved out of the managed care capitation rates from DHS to the Department of Health. They distributed, we collected, they distributed beginning July 1st, 2010. This action results in a one-time savings in fiscal year 11. Okay, so just to summarize it, there's $45 million savings around MERC. $17 million roughly because of the federal cap, the $72 million cap. The other is a $28 million one-time capture or reduction of MERC payments. Then it goes back to normal after that. We wanted to make sure that we do not impact the medical education funds that are going out as much as we first were looking at, and so we restored or we corrected the 2009 unallotment and delayed really the effect of this, other than the federal cap, delayed the effect of this until 2011.
Commissioner, if you could get me, let's say, what we spent or went to Merck and in 2007, 2009, and then what you just talked about, and it would be. This is extremely complicated. Mm-hmm. You know, the dish is not an easy thing to understand either. But if you could get those numbers for me, I would appreciate it. And we will certainly hear testimony from the people that have received the MERC money in the past. Obviously there's no federal bill yet, but there is money for primary care education in the stimulus package, at least in the House. Do you have any idea where that is going to end up?
Mr. Chairman, no, we've not followed that part of it. I would think the Health Department probably is following that. They're following the health information technology piece and some of the medical education pieces. So we're just following the Medicaid side of it. But we will provide that schematic to you, exactly how money comes in to DHS and distributed by the health department.
And what changed when and why did...
Well, exactly. We have a schematic that we started already to kind of lay that out. So, and you want to go back to 2007?
Yeah.
Okay, we will do that.
Thank you.
Chairman, page 125, this proposal would make a 1 percentile reduction in the fee-for-service pharmacy reimbursement rate. It would reduce the current rate of average wholesale price minus 14% to average wholesale price minus 15% for fee-for-service medical assistance and DAMC only. Managed care, they do their own deal in terms of how they pay, how they negotiate with pharmacies. And, so this applies just to our fee-for-service part. This change would apply to all MA and DAMC fee-for-service pharmacy prescriptions except specialty products and products purchased under what's called 340B arrangements that Mayo and University and others may have. The reduction would apply to branded drugs and to the few generic products that are not priced using what we call the maximum allowable cost program, which I referred to earlier, that we're very good at doing. This is also a $2.4 million savings in general funds.
That's true.
Representative Abler.
I don't mean to monopolize the conversation, but I've sat through this discussion for a while. This is the ones that write to us every so often, and they're about to dispense below cost, I think, some of these groups. And have you considered the tipping point about access, and if some of these groups, like the provider cuts, at some point they can't afford to serve your people anymore, and you got a card that's worth nothing, even though they have access and they're covered. And I know you're just a messenger, so I'm not asking you in that light. Has the department considered some of these pharmacies and the bigger ones who just are going to give up and then not give access? And how will those people do it then?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Aver, our best gauge for that is what they get paid in terms of the commercial side, the private sector side. And this we still think is in the ballpark of what they get paid there. Now, on the private side, there's a pass-through of the 2% wholesale tax. We don't pay for that. That's one difference. So comparing rates here, the spending fee or the acquisition costs, we don't pay for the 2% wholesale tax. And the private sector, that's a pass-through. However, AWP minus 15 plus 365 is certainly in the ballpark. In fact, most of the spending fees are less than 365 in the commercial market. And AWP ranges. I think this is not a huge change, 1%. So I think this is still in the ballpark about what pharmacies get paid in the private sector. Thus, we don't believe it's going to be an impact. You need to ask them.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I appreciate that explanation. We'll see. Thank you.
Page 126. This proposal eliminates the enhanced payments to hospitals in Greater Minnesota for certain diagnoses under the MA and DAMC programs. The proposal eliminates the enhanced payment of the greater of a hospital's cost-based rate, or 90% of the 7-county metro average rate. That's how it's calculated today. Again, we pay hospitals based on a specific cost. So some hospitals are more expensive than others, and I'm not, over time, we need to think about whether or not that's a good payment methodology. In fact, when we get to payment reform activities and opportunities, I think we need to revisit how we pay for hospital services and revisit how we pay for any services. But so under these 16 DRGs, Greater Minnesota hospitals, not just rural hospitals, but Greater Minnesota hospitals get paid the higher of 90% of the metro hospital rate or their specific cost as calculated minus the rateable reductions that have taken place. I don't want to give the impression that we pay hospitals their cost because we have rateable reductions over the last 4 or 5 years that thus have been allowed for reduction in their rates to be below their cost. So one problem comparing it to metro average, though, is we talked about medical education just recently, a lot of medical education costs in some of the major metro hospitals. So comparing it to metro hospitals is not probably the right comparison. But again, the primary purpose of this proposal is to find savings, and so we don't cut further in eligibility, to be honest.
Well, members, they're getting 90% of what they get in the Twin Cities. And I can tell you, before we had that bill, Mankato got paid about $1,200 for a normal delivery. And one hospital in the Twin Cities gets $5,500. And this doesn't get them even with it. It gets them up to 90% of what... And I would also say the Minneapolis paper was incorrect yesterday, or 2 days ago, whenever that... You probably all got that thing delivered to you. They in there was a statement that, well, we don't have to worry about rural hospitals because they'll get... They're all critical access hospitals. Well, first of all, they're not all critical access hospitals. And even those that are critical access hospitals, the... More than half of the ones that are critical access hospitals are only getting the 90% rate. So that most rural hospitals, if we pass this, will see a significant decrease in the amount of money they get. And this will be brought up, and I'll have things to hand out when we have that joint meeting next week.
Yeah, there's 79 hospitals, Mr. Chairman, that receive these payments. You're right, they're not... There's also a new, another provision in law.
I have a Representative Hodge has a question.
Well, Mr. Chair, the question I was going to ask, I wanted to get a specific response from Commissioner Osberg here, but he actually said the response I wanted to say was comparing to the metro rate probably isn't the best way to go. And I just want to reiterate that. I mean, a lot of the, I think comparing costs to the metro hospitals is unfair. Medical technology costs the same whether you're in rural Minnesota or in the metropolitan area. We all know about the arms race. We're trying to get some qualified doctors and personnel to work in medical settings, and that's a very real reality when it comes to labor costs for outstate Minnesota. So I know what the short-term approach on this is, but I hope we can keep that in mind and maybe address a better mechanism for the needs into the future on this. So.
Well, Representative Hodge, I would also say that the nurses, hospital nurses, get paid exactly the same in Duluth as they get paid in the Twin Cities, as they get paid in St. Cloud, and as they get paid in Rochester. So that there's an equal cost they have for their nurses, yet their reimbursements are not the same.
Chairman, page 128, this proposal would eliminate the hospital quarterly payment under medical assistance effective July 1st of 2009. These quarterly payments are add-ons to the current base inpatient rate. Eliminating the quarterly payments will not have any impact on existing rates paid to hospitals, which are based on hospital-specific costs, as I mentioned, that are rebased every 2 years. This quarterly payment actually goes down over time. As you can see in this page, that the savings associated with this goes down because before this payment is made, we take 3% or 4% off of that amount in order to, which really was in lieu of a additional rateable reduction. So, remember, a few years ago, we talked about what the rateable reduction was going to be for hospitals when we try to solve that financial situation. We said that we'll take, instead of an additional 4% rateable reduction, we will take 4% of this, these funds off first before we distribute these money. So, however, it's still a loss to hospitals, no doubt about it. This is not DSH money, however. This is add-on to DSH money. We maximize, we're a low DSH state, means we maximize federal money available, called disproportionate share resources that are available to us. This goes beyond that, and it's a lot complicated with this, but it also affects what's called an upper payment limit. This is where you need to. This is where we need to sit down and talk about how we're very effective at absorbing the upper payment limit. Meaning, we can't pay more than what Medicare pays. That's kind of the general limit we have. Again, this is. I think we need to sit down and go over you in detail how this all works, so you can see the interaction of this with other, the safety net intergovernmental transfer program is an interaction with the IPT program for safety net hospitals. And I think you'll find it's very interesting as we break this down as to how we pay hospitals today. But this eliminates that quarterly payment.
again, in order for us to avoid further eligibility cuts.
Versus enabler. And before that, I should have said something in my previous discourse, but virtually all the non-metro hospitals have a much higher rate of medical assistance and Minnesota Care and Medicare patients. The hospitals in Rochester don't fall into the high rate level, but most of the greater Minnesota hospitals have about 60% of their patients, public paid patients. And so when we pay them less than what the private pay do, it has a much bigger impact on them than does on the Twin Cities hospitals.
Mr.
So, Aberg, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, thank you. I'll just restate my question about how much we pay hospitals. And this is all part of that. But I just reading the text here, Gillespie spent a good deal of time around here making their case about how they have a very high MA population. And are you concerned? I know that you wish them to continue doing that. Have they been talked to about this? And do you think they can continue serving people as they have? Or do you expect that they'll be seeing less people because of this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the money is distributed right, in part by the medical assistance volume they have, but it's distributed in a broader network of providers, and the safety net intergovernmental transfers is distributed to a smaller net group of safety net hospitals. So that has a bigger impact. This impacts all the hospitals, but again, differently depending on their level of MA volume. So that's a factor. Mr. Chairman, page 129, this proposal provides incentive payments. This proposal would eliminate the outreach incentive program and grants. This program provides an incentive payment to organizations that directly identify and assist potential enrollees to fill out and submit an application for Minnesota healthcare programs. For each successful enrollment, the organization receives $25. This proposal reduces the projected average monthly enrollment assumed in the forecast for MA and Minnesota Care by 5,300 enrollees by fiscal year 2011, but does not impact currently enrolled individuals. As you'll see, there's the eligibility impact in terms of people in our programs, and there's an enrollment effect, because some of the enrollment effect is based on people not yet enrolled in our programs. And we'll make that distinction as we go through that. But roughly, of the 113,000 people that are going to be affected in terms of enrollment in our program, 84,000 are currently enrolled, and other 30,000 roughly are not yet enrolled. And we'll talk about the timing of these things so you understand the full impact. There's an eligibility effect and there's an enrollment effect in these proposals that you need to make a distinction on. But elimination of this effort would save money because of the enrollment effect of outreach. We're also looking at the federal stimulus package as to whether or not there's any outreach aspect to that. There is maybe in the SCHEP legislation some incentive to do more outreach, but we're not sure if the stimulus package is going to address the question of what outreach do we need to do. Mr. Chairman, going back to page 96 now, I want to go over the proposal that would reduce the payment rate for basic health care services by 3% under MA and DAMC. This is commonly referred to as a ratable reduction. The 3% ratable reduction would also apply to managed care agreements. This change would be effective July 1st, 2009 for fee-for-service and arrangements, and January 1st, 2010 for managed care contracts in order to align with the timing of our managed care agreements. This proposal excludes payments for drugs, medical supplies, and prosthetics, lab and radiology, and medical transportation. That does apply to all of the providers.
So, Mr. Osberg, why did you exclude radiology?
There's a better line.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to have to ask somebody from our area to address that issue. I don't know offhand.
Mr. Chair, I'm Jeff Schiff, the medical director at DHS. Radiology was put into the calculation with the lab at that time and was not specifically singled out, and that's why it was included in bulk in that. So it was there was some debate about whether it should be excluded, and in the end, we decided to leave it in as an exclusion.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
Just for our data purposes, what would that be worth if we included, is radiology including all scans and all that, MRIs and all those advanced scanning too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I'll have to get back to you on this total.
Yeah, we might want to know a number just to know.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You didn't really explain why. I mean, you said there was debate about it, but so why are you excluding radiology?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think the exclusions were meant to look at services where there was it was thought that the reductions would could not be adequately absorbed, and that was part of the discussion. I will have to. I wasn't part of that initial conversation, so I will have to get back to you for more detail on that.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would really appreciate that. I mean, I think we need to know what the thinking is behind these various things so that we can decide whether we agree with that thinking.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm now going to turn to the benefit changes. And if you look, in terms of reference, look at pages 13 and 14 in the green section. This lists the benefits for each of our programs and for each of our population groups. And then on pages 23 and 24 in the green section of your book, this is a list of mandatory Medicaid services and optional Medicaid services based on the federal determination, federal government determination of our Medicaid programs. So this will give you an idea as to, as we looked at optional Medicaid benefits, as we considered potential cuts, this is the list that we looked at. It includes pharmacy, for example. We obviously didn't go there with a pharmacy elimination, but it does include that and many other optional benefits. Minnesota has maximized the number of services covered and it includes all the optional benefits up to this point. But page 101, I'm going to go over the four benefits that were
Radberg, page 23, I think, is. I appreciate having this in there because I've always wondered what those were.
Mr. Chairman, and we can also provide any kind of breakdown in terms of costs of these benefits if the committee needs to go in that kind of direction. Page 101. This proposal would discontinue coverage for chiropractic services for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above for MA, CAMC, and Minnesota Care. Chiropractic services are optional, as indicated, and are covered. However, they are covered under Medicare. And we have 100,000 of our 700,000 clients that are covered under Medicare, and we'll continue to pay the coinsurance and deductibles for those dual eligibles. However, other adults in our program will not then have this service available. This is effective January 1st, 2010. The fiscal analysis for this proposal assumes that 20% of the chiropractic services shift to other services, such as orthopedic assistant services. This results in a $1.26 million total savings.
Mr. Osberg, your timing was perfect, right after Representative Abler left the room. So, let's...
He was waiting.
Moving on real quickly.
But I can give his speech. It's pretty clear that for acute lower back pain, chiropractors can do just as good as orthopedic people and do it cheaper.
And Mr. Chairman, this is not in the statement about the value of chiropractic services. This is, again, strictly a financial exercise. Mr. Chairman, on page 102, this proposal would discontinue dental coverage for non-pregnant adults, age 21 and above, for MA. Again, dental coverage is an optional benefit under federal regulations. Dental coverage will continue for children through age 20, pregnant women. Adults would continue to receive emergency dental care through hospital emergency departments. And any procedures that are underway, the effective date of this would be covered as well. Now, the fiscal analysis for this proposal assumes that savings are offset by a 10% increase in fiscal 10 and a 5% increase in fiscal and every year after that in terms of a shift to emergency care services. We realize that the effect of this is going to result in more people needing to get care in emergency rooms.
Well, Mr. Asper, I'd also say that if you have an adult diabetic on medical assistance and he doesn't get dental care, it destroys his ability to maintain his glucose levels. So you're going to also see extra cost in that area when they show up when their glucose is out of control in the emergency room. Representative Thiessen.
Nothing.
Page 104, Mr. Chairman, going back to 104, or going to 104, this proposal would discontinue podiatry services for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above. Again, podiatry is an optional benefit. This proposal reduces general fund spending by $1.2 million in 10 and 11 biennium, and healthcare access fund spending by $11,000 for the 10 and 11 biennium. There's a 50% offset here in terms of other services being provided. Without any, we can get you specific services, but we, again, podiatry services probably end up being provided more by physicians, orthopedic physicians, and other primary care physicians. And so there's a 50% offset assumed in terms of the fiscal impact of this. Page 105, Mr. Chairman, this proposal would discontinue rehabilitative services for non-pregnant adults age 21 and above for MADMC and Minnesota Care. The elderly and persons with disabilities with long-term chronic and debilitating conditions, as well as children with chronic conditions, receive the majority of rehabilitative services. Again, rehabilitative services are covered under Medicare for the 100,000 adults we have on Medicare, and our programs will continue to pay the co-insurance and deductible towards that Medicare coverage. For children under 21, rehabilitative services are covered through our early and periodic screening and diagnostic and treatment benefits. So for children with special needs, rehab services will be made available. There's a 70% offset here in terms of other costs being incurred, especially in inpatient costs or other services. So a 70% offset is assumed in terms of other costs being incurred. This results in a $6.7 million general fund savings. Again, large part, we want to avoid further eligibility cuts. We try to preserve medical assistance eligibility and DAMC eligibility as best we can. And frankly, then we have to look at these four optional benefits. We didn't go beyond that. Mr. Chairman, page 112, going up to 112 at this point.
just eliminate.
Well, Commissioner, just one thing. You did not, like the last time we had to do this, or I should say the last time this was done, psychologists were eliminated, and you did not do that this time?
No, Mr. Chairman, we didn't eliminate psychology services. We didn't eliminate any services, but psychology services, mental health services are not certainly, which are an option, by the way. Mental health services are not affected by this. They will continue to be a benefit. Any mental health service.
Okay.
Page 112, Mr. Chairman, this proposal would eliminate the patient incentive grant program. This grant program would provide incentives and rewards to enrollees who have met personal health goals established with the patient's primary care providers in managing a chronic disease such as diabetes. This was enacted by the 2007 legislature to mirror what we're doing on the provider side. We have we've been partnering with the employer community to provide an incentive to providers if their patients reach an optimal standard of care for diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and depression and asthma. So we're hoping to do the same thing for our patients, give them a reward, but at this point we're unable to financially continue that. So it's a $982,000 savings in the 10-11 biennium. Now, Mr. Chairman, we'll go to the eligibility changes. And what I'd like to do is refer you to page 17 back in the green section. And there's a graph there that shows our current eligibility standards. And you should have another graph that shows what it would look like after the governor's proposals are considered. So you should have two such graphs. It looks like this, colorful. Look at page 17. It should be a second one. You got two of them or not?
No.
It's just one.
We just have one, I think. We have the current eligibility one.
Yeah, the current one with the green Minnesota Care and transitional Minnesota Care, green color. What do we have?
That's what we have.
That's what you have.
If you could just get that to us.
Yes, we'll get that to you. But I'll point out where the governor's proposal. I'll reference this graph and point out where the governor's proposal would cut. It would cut. If you look at our adults without children, it would the four boxes, the four green boxes there. GAMC would be retained. The other three would go away. The GHO for hospital only, which is a very small program, and again, they're not enrollees in the program. It's an episodic payment arrangement. Minnesota Care, 200%, and transitional Minnesota Care. Those three would be eliminated. Mm-hmm. Parents under 275, under Minnesota Care, parents up to 275, under families and children, under it's a blue bar. That would go away. And parents would be covered through the box in the left lower corner. The parents 100%. The parents 100%. The parents up to 100% are covered under medical assistance, but no parents would be covered under Minnesota Care. And all children would be covered under medical assistance. So children 150%. Children under Minnesota Care all be shifted over to medical assistance. So again, there's no eligibility changes for kids, but the kids under 150% of SPD would be covered through medical assistance. And so what would be remaining in Minnesota Care are children above 150% of SPD, up to 275%. Children 2 to 18, and also children 19 and 20 above 100% of SPD up to 275%. So the Minnesota Care program would in essence be a children's health insurance program covering kids between 100 and 275%. And we'll get that's the change
everything on the right-hand side stays the same under medical assistance. We are not changing medical assistance eligibility or general assistance medical care eligibility. But the 84,000 people who will be disenrolled are adults without kids and parents in Minnesota care. And but there's an enrollment effect in others, too, as I talked about. And that graph that you've been given details the enrollment effect by category. Well, Mr. Chairman,
Representative Dean has a question or comment. Where is it? There he is.
I'm right here. Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Osberg, could you talk about, are these disenrollments going to happen at the same time, or are they rolled out?
They vary. Adults without children will be disenrolled January of 2010. Parents in Minnesota care will be disenrolled July of 2010 or upon federal approval. Now, I can go, obviously, and I'll go into detail right now in terms of each of the proposals. I'm not sure how much more time you have today to...
Representative Saul, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was curious, then, under Minnesota care, the parents and the children are paying a premium for their share. I mean, the state is paying some, but they're paying a premium, so then when they go to medical assistance, they wouldn't pay any premium?
Chairman, that is correct. Medical assistance, they would not be paying a premium. The federal government has made it clear to us that we have to make sure the people who shouldn't be paying a premium are not paying a premium, and we agree with that. Why should, you know, some of the people leave Minnesota care because they can't pay the premium. So they should be medical assistance. So our proposal, which we go into detail on, tries to simplify this so those kids under 150% are in MA automatically and not in Minnesota care. We think that's an important principle here going forward. Even though the premium is like is real nominal, $4 a month, but still, some cases we know there's some people who leave Minnesota care that may be eligible for MA, but leave Minnesota care because there's a lack of paying premiums. Why they didn't pay premiums, we don't know. So we're trying to. This will streamline the way we administer our programs, the way we develop systems to support our program. This will streamline. This is what Wisconsin did effectively, not maybe through the way by cutting a lot of the programs, but effectively simplifying the programs in order to better manage it. And that's one thing we want to accomplish, notwithstanding what happens this session. We want to accomplish the simplification and streamlining of our programs. Mr. Chairman, page 113 is the beginning of the series of proposals relating to eligibility changes. This proposal would simplify program eligibility standards and provide greater operational support and oversight to improve county administration of Minnesota healthcare programs. We are requesting a state investment in making this happen. We are asking for resources to do this so we can accomplish this objective I just talked about. DHS established a joint state-county advisory committee to help identify ways to simplify and streamline human services and administrative requirements. The result of this county and state partnership is something called Minnesota Healthcare Connect. The resulting report recommended improvements, many of which are incorporated in this proposal. The goals of this proposal are, one, to reduce program complexity. Number two is increase statewide operational support and oversight. Number three is reduce county administrative costs. Number four is to improve client services. Number five is to reduce system costs. Number six is to reduce reduce enrollee confusion and increase workload from additional renewal notices. And this is what we're trying to accomplish. As I said, Minnesota care would be pregnant. In Minnesota care, it would be children 2 to 18, up to above 150% to 275, and children 19 and 20 above 100% of poverty up to 275. That's who will be left in Minnesota care. We're talking about, in fact, if you look at the graph that indicates the enrollment effect, there's an error here in terms of how many kids are in Minnesota care in 2013 and how many are in MA. There's actually going to be 11,000 children in Minnesota care in 2013 and
8,000 fewer in medical assistance. We'll update that graph for you. So that's the one error that's in that enrollment graph. But by and large, as I said, medical assistance, I mean, Minnesota Care becomes, under these set of proposals, a children's health insurance program. And then we will benefit, as we talked about, from the SCHIP legislation, because SCHIP now pays for kids as opposed to adults, as opposed to parents, which it did before last fall's renewal of our waiver. So SCHIP will be made available for kids above 133%. SCHIP means 65% federal money instead of 50% federal money. That's what the important distinction is between Children's Health Insurance Program and Medicaid, that we have additional federal participation. So that's
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Commissioner, the work that this group has been doing since the OLA report of 2007, do you think it was the goal of the group to simplify these programs by eliminating eligibility as is being proposed now, or is eligibility elimination a result of the budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, it's the latter, certainly. No, they didn't recommend elimination or reduction of programs. They just said they were impressed how complex we had structured these programs. Any downsizing of our programs does lend to the ability for us to simplify it, certainly, but that's not necessarily the objective.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, if this is an area that I think a number of us have been interested in, so if the legislature and through this process decided that all of these eligibility cuts were not the direction that we wanted to go, would the effort to do program simplification continue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, certainly. In fact, we want to talk about streamlining administrative services around our programs and simplifying our programs. So I think we can address this notwithstanding any changes to eligibility.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. I am wondering, to date, there's been a fair amount of work done on the simplification process, and how has that been funded thus far?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we have done that internally in terms of our staff resources. We had resources available to contract with a consultant called PSI to help the county and state advisory committee to think through how best to structure our administration of eligibility over time. And so we paid for that through our administrative resources internally.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one final question. As the work proceeds, is there room for legislative oversight or participation in this work?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there's always room for legislative oversight in terms of how we go about doing this. In fact, it's critical. We can't make this work successful if you don't, the legislature does not adopt some of the changes that we need in terms of aligning eligibility standards and things of that sort, or giving us the necessary resources to invest in our ability to improve on this. And we need to demonstrate to you that it's in the interest of our clients and the counties and the state to do this, and we're prepared to make that argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just to let people know, we're going to go to 2:40, and then we'll adjourn the meeting, and we will not be coming back tonight. We'll try to fit the rest of the Human Services presentation in sometime next week, but that may involve an evening. Yeah. Representative Abler.
Thanks a bunch tonight, by the way. My back was a little sore from that of the discussion. I have a question. If the department could summarize for me and for us, I think it might help us get the big picture. I've kind of identified four different areas of changes. You got the programmatic cuts, which would be hospitals and podiatrists and all that part. You have the shifts, or whatever you call them. There's the eligibility pieces and the enrollment pieces. It would help me, I think, to help if we could. I looked at the charts, and it would be hard to add up for me, but maybe somebody could make a chart of those different pieces of the four elements up to understand, unless I maybe forgot a fifth one, but that would help me, I think,
understand. Mr. Chairman, certainly we can categorize the
the physical impact in those six categories that we presented today. And we could do that. We could summarize that for you. Yeah.
For next time, whenever you get that.
Yeah, we'll have that too right away.
Representative Thiessen.
Before we end, it would be helpful to look at page 23 of the budget book too, and just get some comments on that. Not of the green pages, but of the actual budget book, which I think is the elimination of the Health Care Access Fund.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, as I just described, the Minnesota Care Program will be, in essence, limited to covering children above 100% poverty for 19 and 20-year-old children and above 150% poverty for children between 2 and 18. That results in 2013, 11,000 enrollees in Minnesota Care compared to 117 or 120,000. At that point, it would not make sense in our minds to have the Health Care Access Fund be contributing just to Minnesota Care. We would think that General Assistance Medical Care, for example, is a program that obviously should be financed aid to the general fund. And so we're proposing that the Health Care Access Fund then be brought in part because of this resulting proposal.
So the governor's not proposing to eliminate the Health Care Access Fund so we can transfer money to the general fund and help our budget, but because of administrative simplification is going to leave the health care Access Fund with no purpose. Is that what you're telling us?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, no.
There may be
other reasons.
What would other reasons be?
Well, I think you've heard the governor talk about that, and that is to finance health care services and other services that are available to the general fund.
And Mr. Chair, do we have, and I don't know if we've seen these numbers, what is it, $600 million in the Health Care Access Fund over the biennium that comes in? Do we know what the number is?
It's not quite that high. It's about a couple of $100 million, I think, per year.
Per year?
Yeah.
Or $600 million for the biennium, roughly, or something.
We'll get that, right?
A couple hundreds of millions.
It is.
Do we know how much of that is going to actually, that once it gets transferred, is actually going to end up paying for health care programs, and how much is going to end up on other stuff?
Mr. Chairman, President Thiessen, no, I do not know that. I don't think it...
And you can't account for that.
I'm not aware that it's dedicated to anything specifically, that the money being shipped over to general fund is not necessarily dedicated to any specific purpose.
Okay.
I'm not aware of the details of that proposal, Mr. Thiessen.
Commissioner, go ahead. Representative Bunch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up, Mr. Commissioner. Since I've arrived here, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I've always understood that the Health Care Access Fund and the provider tax that supported it, what the agreement that was implicit when that was passed was that this was the fund for subsidized sliding-scale medical assistance for working Minnesota families and not for medical assistance to the GMAC. First of all, is that correct in terms of its origination? And secondly, if we move it over and generally use it for medical care of all types or other things, and moreover, if we no longer allow it to be used for payments of PT, OT, and various other kinds of things under MA, which those providers pay the tax, I would suspect many of us, if not all of us in the legislature, are going to feel extreme pressure from the provider groups that made that implicit agreement to remove the tax in fairly short stead. So I wondered how much that played in your deliberations about making this change.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bond, I think you're correct in terms of the characterization of the original intent of the Health Care Access Fund, which is supported by a provider tax and a premium tax, and of course enrolling premiums, that it was to be a stand-alone Minnesota Care program. We've found that it's not necessarily in the interest to have a lot of people otherwise eligible for general assistance medical care or MA being in Minnesota Care if that's benefited by being in the proper program. And so, as I said earlier, this, obviously these set of proposals result in a major downsize in the Minnesota Care program. Even under current levels of the $245 million
for example, per year in terms of health care access fund, that pales compared to the overall health care cost, which is about, in our programs, is about, with federal money included, about $5 billion a year. So it's a very small portion of the money, state money that goes towards health care, goes through the health care access fund. So it's not, larger scheme of things, it's not that material. Now, as I said, in terms of your point about how this impacts people, providers, now the provider tax is a pass-through tax. It's not unlike a sales tax. Providers pass that on to employers or to health plans. And the reason there's a provider tax is because that way we can affect the ability to pass it on to self-funded employers who otherwise are exempt from any kind of state regulation around any tax. That was the basis for a provider tax back in the early 90s. And that's a tax that is passed on to the payer eventually. It's not absorbed by the provider. It's like a sales tax is not absorbed by a retail organization.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Osberg, I'm wondering if you can have the department at some point provide me a source or a place to look for a easy way to look at all the healthcare spending and where it's coming from that's not separated in pages. I'm just looking for how much of it is actually out of the general fund, how much is out of the healthcare access fund. And then from there, I'm also looking at finding some information out related to the uses of the healthcare access fund today that are not Minnesota Care uses, because I think the original intent was Minnesota Care, but last year I recall a number of other uses of the healthcare access fund dollars for the purposes of other things related to healthcare, but not Minnesota Care. So just wondering if you can get a breakdown at some point. I don't need it today, but I think that'd be good information for us to have as we have this debate related to the healthcare access fund and what it's supposed to be used for versus what it is currently used for versus what the proposal is. So I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, we'll do that. In fact, page 11, as has been pointed out to me on your book, there is a breakdown of some of that already, but maybe once you look at that, if you want more detail, let us know. We'd be glad to provide that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Steve.
Yeah, just my understanding of the proposal is that it wouldn't be like allocating between the health care access fund for certain things or the general fund. This proposal is just, there would be no health care access fund, right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Steve.
So you'd never be able to compile the list that's on page 11.
I think, well,
I mean, if we were to go with this proposal.
Mr. Chairman, right. I think there's based on how it's currently used, health care access fund is currently used, and how it compares to others, I think it's a good exercise, and we will break that down, assuming the health care access fund continues as it is today.
Could you wrap up in a minute or two?
Chairman, I don't know if I could do that, but I could try. I have covered... let me do this. Why don't I just go to page... I want to talk about the stimulus package. Page 99. Page 99 details the Minnesota Care eligibility for parents piece. This is the one provision, again, that we talked about limiting coverage for parents in Minnesota Care. And again, parents would be covered in medical assistance up to 100% of SPG. This is where there could be a potential interaction with the federal stimulus package. This is, as we understand in fact, it's pretty clear in the language that there needs to be what's called a maintenance of effort requirement in order for us to be eligible for any of the stimulus money. And so we would not be able to make an eligibility change that affects medical assistance. In fact, what the legislation says that no change can take place from what the July 1st of 2008 eligibility standards, methods, and procedures looked like. So this would obviously be altered in a major way if indeed the stimulus package was enacted. Now, the stimulus package provides for increase in a temporary increase. You've got to keep that in mind as well. It's a temporary increase, 2 years of federal money. Right now we get 50% federal money, and the stimulus package, depending on which
speech, you look at which is the House and the Senate language, increases that for a two-year period of time. That results in roughly a little less than a $2 billion effect for the state based on current language. Now, we would have to find out exactly what terms and conditions there would be associated with that $2 billion. But this is the one page that would, in this package, that would be directly affected by any stimulus package.
Representative Broad.
I just have a quick question. I'm thinking about the House language in the stimulus package, and if I am correct, and I may not be, but my understanding is that it contains a provision that says that we cannot require political subdivisions to contribute a greater share of the non-federal amount. So essentially, that to me is kind of our MOE to the counties. And the MOE to the county, or the MOE to the county, as of September 30th, was repealed. So my question to you, and I don't know if you can answer it today, is if we pass House File 45 or whatever 95, the MOE bill, which replaces the requirement on counties, are we already in violation of what the stimulus package will require? And I'm trying to figure out the link between those two things, because as of September, there were no requirements under the counties in law. There were maybe in practice, but not certainly in law.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, let's take a closer look at that, but there are no maintenance of effort requirements for counties relating to medical assistance. There are some efforts around mental health funding, for example, and some chemical dependency funding, I believe, but not around
child protection.
Yeah. The state relieved the counties of their share of Medicaid years ago, and so they don't participate in terms of the federal, the financial side of Medicaid at this point, or general assistance medical care.
Well, Mr. Commissioner, we're going to have to quit now, but thank you for your presentation. I know it's very difficult for you to do this, but we may alter, obviously, what the governor's done, but we're all going to have to make cuts, and somebody's going to suffer. So thank you, Mr. Commissioner Osberg.
Thank you.
Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.